Some question.
We have a question from Madhavilata Devidasi from Holland.
Oh, all right.
Very short question. We live on this earth as an imprison. Can you tell something more about it?
We live on this earth as if in a prison?
As in prison.
In prison. It reminds me of a Virginia Woolf quote about how we're viewed by other people, imprisoned by the way they see us. But Chayeva yasya bhuvanani bibharti durga. Durga Devi is said to be the superintendent of the prison. And there are numerous examples of the modes of nature being compared to rope, guna. Another meaning of guna is rope. We talked the other day, vidyate hridaya granti, the noose around the heart. Because, see, if we hear the word heart, we think like either the physical heart or just the metaphorical romantic heart. But to quote another poet, Yeats, he said in his Innisfree poem, he has a line, in the deep heart's core. He's talking about what he hears in the deep heart's core, how he interprets things. And the core, anyone here speak Spanish? Corazón, I think, is the Spanish word for heart. But core, the earth, the core always means in the most central position. But so what is it that is roped or noosed, knotted? If we say the heart is bound, means your consciousness. Because it's not the physical heart. So it means the core of our consciousness has been knotted, is bound, and therefore unable to express itself. Because the heart doesn't express itself with knowledge. That's mental or intellectual. The heart has another type of expression. It has another type of food. Knowledge doesn't feed the heart. Knowledge doesn't educate the heart. The heart, the core consciousness, as Guru Maharaj said in the sequence of Sat Chit Anandam, it is chit, or consciousness, that allows you to feel. Right? So, to feel what? Anandam, pleasure or happiness. So if we follow this sequence or this example, then we'll understand if the core consciousness of a living being is encased by some substance through which it cannot penetrate, then the only self-expression there is like Guru Maharaj speaking of Chidabhas, where I said Chayeva Yasya Bhuvanani Bibharti Durga, I'll come back to that. So it means all of this so-called self-expression is a shadow representation of the self or core consciousness. So in that sense, it's not real. Everyone is very much interested in what is real or authentic or your authentic self, living your truth of your authentic self. And that it has a nice ring to it, nice humanistic ring to it, but if your actual core consciousness, which represents your most authentic self, is enveloped by layers and layers of what Guru Maharaj calls acquired prejudice and acquired tendency, then what is this self-expression? Like the, what's an example of when, you know, well, I look at these lenses, there's something, maybe it's for photographers, you know, lens distortion. You know what lens distortion is, right? So only on the more expensive lenses, even there you have it, but it means that you'll see this when you take selfies. You'll take a picture of yourself and your hand is bigger than your head because it's a lower quality lens. And unless you get it just right, you're shooting from below and it looks like your hand is like sometimes twice the size of your head. So some people could care less or they don't care about it. Other people, known as photographers, do. So they had a big problem shooting buildings. You have a lens, you put it in front of a building and it looks, it's distorted. So they used what, large format cameras with certain lenses and then tilt and all these little things so that you could accurately take a picture of a building. Not an easy thing to do. And, you know, to keep it all the way it actually looks. Otherwise, it's all distorted. So when your consciousness is in a distortion field, rajagun, tama, raja, sattva, the modes of nature, it's all being filtered through that. It's not pure self-expression. It's a shadow representation of the self. And you see, like, are shadows visible while I'm speaking somewhere? You know, cameraman, go to a shadow. So we know when you observe shadows, like, it moves with the original. It has certain characteristics of the original. But how much would you say? I mean, a shadow representation of something means there's no substance there. That's what we're dealing with in the what's otherwise been called the shadow world, the prison, whatever you want to call it. Think of that. In this context, your soul would be like the original substantial thing, and the shadow, it's just a nothing, almost a nothing representation of the actual, of the original. There's no substance there, no depth, no feeling, nothing. It's similar to that, right? So Guru Maharaj and his subjective evolution of consciousness, he says, like we say, sat chit anandam. There's the chit jagat. That means the spiritually conscious world, right? Because again, remember, the substantial world that we aspire to through service is comprised of consciousness. See, we think like this is the real, we want something like that. You know, you can walk on it, you can build on it. It's substantial. This is the insubstantial thing that appears for some time and then vanishes. It's the conscious world that is substantial. And when we speak of the spiritual world, we're not talking in a generic sense of just abstract, impersonal, an ocean of consciousness. Ocean of consciousness, no doubt. Like Guru Maharaj said, the whole objective world is like an iceberg floating in an ocean of consciousness. That's not the end of the story, that's the beginning. So he's saying consciousness can hold within it, you know, subjective concepts like black, white, light, heavy, up, down, what are other dimensions? What are they? Depth, you know, height, width, depth. As Guru Maharaj said, all of these are subjective concepts. And a cluster of subjective concepts makes an object. That's subjective evolution of consciousness. So that spiritual world is comprised of consciousness, right? But what was the point I was making before that?
Substantial and unsubstantial. Before. Nothing representation of our original shadow.
Oh, shadow representation. So the chit jagat, the spiritually conscious world, we are now in what is called the achit jagat. That means it's dull matter, right? But you have chit subjects navigating the achit world. That's the bizarre circumstance we find ourselves in. We are chit subjects, spiritually conscious subjects, navigating a world of matter. But Guru Maharaj, and this comes from him, it's another one of his original concepts. He's saying, it's not that like the soul can just start moving this stuff around, right? A soul, you know, for whatever reason, is now navigating the material world. It can't work that way. So, because thankfully, says in the Vedas, the Sangha Hyam Purusha, the soul is never infected or contaminated by the modes of nature. That's the good news. It's never touched by it, actually. It's impossible. Then he's saying, well, then what's all the fuss about? Is through misidentification. That's all it is. It's a big thing. But it's not like the soul is polluted and then you have to somehow get all that pollution out of it, or like the way we clean clothes. It's not like that. It's only through misconception, misidentification. It's never actually transformed, polluted, infected, infested by the modes of nature. It's an illusion. But anyway, so Guru Maharaj introduced his conception of chidabhas. So chit, consciousness, he's saying abhas or chayabhas means a shadow representation of consciousness. So it's the shadow representation of the soul in the form of ego, intelligence, mind, in which a body can be built upon. On a subtle body of mind, intellect, and ego, you can build the working senses, active senses. Like in Gita, indriyani paranyahur indriyebhya paramanaha, manasastu parabudhe yo budhe paratastu saha. These are the objects of the senses, right? Things that we can see, hear, taste, touch, smell. But what do we do that with? The working senses, right? The eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, right? And tactile sensation. But for that to happen, for us to perceive, the mind has to be functioning, right? Like the English expression, one that's synonymous with losing your mind, is they'll say, have you lost your senses? Right? We also know when, in neurological sciences, it's very interesting, they'll say you have an itch, like here, sometimes there's some mosquitoes, very persistent time mosquitoes, or some other kind, right? That they, through analysis and research, they found when you have that itch, it's something, I might have the numbers a little off, but not by much. They'll say, it's 15% stimulus, right? The itch. It's 15% of what's there. The other 85% of what you experience is in your mind. That's not going to help you so much when you have to itch. But they've studied that. 15% at the source of the stimulus or stimuli, whatever, 85% is in your mind. That you can't tolerate, you have to, you know, itch it. So the mind is the seat of all sense experience. And we know when someone is, what's another expression? Absent-minded. So say you're studying very hard, and someone's like calling your name and you're not responding. And they're repeatedly calling your name until finally you go like, oh, what? And they go, didn't you hear me calling you? I called your name like 5 times. No, I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Now, let's say they made a video of that. Right? So you could show on the video the person was calling your name and you weren't answering. And in addition to that, we did some scientific monitoring and we saw the, whatever it is, the cochlea and the fine hairs, and, you know, like doing what they do. All of that was there. And still you say, I didn't hear you. It's very interesting. So literally, sound was being made. Literally, hearing was taking place through the working sense of ear. But the person, because they were absent-minded, didn't hear anything. So it underscores the idea that the mind is the seat of all sense experience. And still, it's a shadow representation of spiritual mind. Then, as we know, mind, like Cheto, Dharpana, Marginal, it's an instrument for reflection. And we know, like mirror, the glass, whatever you put before it, it must reflect. It cannot choose not to reflect it. That's how the mind, it has no independent discriminatory ability. Something's put before it, that's why we find ourselves sometimes conceiving of like ridiculous things that are just, we're not going to do or not going to happen just because something came before our eyes or we saw something. So then, manasastu prabuddhe, superior to that, and that means finer, going towards the subtle, is the intelligence, the discrimination factor, telling the mind, like, don't think like that. Right? Giving some advice. So it's moving towards the subtle. And if we... I'm not a geneticist, I'm not a scientist, but one thing we learned from genetic engineering is if you want to clone someone, you just need some DNA. You know, like on a rainy night like this, Lord Byron, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and Mary Shelley, they were in a Schloss in Germany somewhere. You understand? Castle, or, you know, three great writers. Shelley, his wife Mary Shelley is also a writer, and Lord Byron, he's a famous English poet and writer. So it's raining, they can't go out, and it's raining like for a long time, so they said, let's make up some stories and, you know, that are scary. I mean, I'm simplifying it, they're probably used, you know, some, you know, highfalutin British accents or something, which I don't feel compelled to do right now. But so they agree, all right, each one's going to write a story. Although the other two ostensibly are more significant writers, no one that I know remembers what Lord Byron or Shelley wrote. But everyone knows what Mary Shelley wrote, because she wrote a story called Prometheus Unbound, which became known in time as Frankenstein, right? That was her story. And in her story, this, you know, the mad scientist, he's collecting body parts. He wants to create life. Gets cadavers from the graveyard and, you know, different body. He's sewing these different body parts together. Right? And as fate would have it, when it came to brain, at least in the classic comic book version, his assistant, Igor, there's like, it says criminal brain and like brain of a real nice guy, you know. And he takes, you know, like, Igor, take the brain of the real nice guy. Yes, boss, you know. And he drops that one. He's saying, oh, I'm in trouble now. So he takes the criminal brain, brings that back, and that's the brain that's put inside. And then the body he puts on the crane, the top of the castle opens up, and the lightning comes and strikes the body, and from there he becomes alive. And the famous scene in the movie, Dr. Frankenstein going, it's alive, it's alive. So that was her story about how you would make life. And it was very crude, sewing different body parts together and then a brain from here, a heart from there. That was like a 19th century take on cloning. I mean, I don't know. I haven't studied it, but maybe she was being... There was a touch of irony in what she was writing. But in the 20th century, they realized, no, no, that's not how you do it. You don't need a whole body. What do you need? A hair. Just a hair, yeah. In their hair, they have some DNA. We can take that DNA and make a dupe. So without going into the implications of that, one thing that we learn from it is that, back to our original point, identity is located in the subtle plane. Right? It's not the gross body. It's not even necessarily the mind, intellect, or ego. It's finer than that. So when he says, manasas tu parabudhe yo budhe paratastu saha, tells Arjuna, you see the sequence going from gross to subtle. Objects of the senses, senses, seat of the senses, perception, sense perception, mind, intelligence, ego, atma. There's the beginning. So Guru Maharaj is saying, all these other things are what? They're chayabhas, chidabhas. They're shadow representations of that self. So in this world, as she said in the beginning about the prison, so it's a shadow world, right? And we're through identification we are bound. That much we can say. So Guru Maharaj speaks of that the actual self is located under layers of acquired prejudice and acquired tendency. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in one place about acquired prejudice, said how whatever prejudices we have, we acquired without thinking, for the most part. Said, but when it's time to let go of one of them, we have to think about it very carefully and for a long time to be sure. But we acquired that, in most cases, without thinking. So we found ourselves in a circumstance, really a karmic circumstance that we are responsible for. Right? We're surrounded by karmic circumstances that we've generated. So therefore, we're of a particular gender, nationality, location, historicity, all of these things. Right? Still, and within that, we're prone toward self-expression, right? And being authentic and living our truth and all these such things. But what self is expressing itself? Right? How real is that? How substantial is that? And our knowledge-acquiring senses, like instruments, if they're not properly calibrated, they're giving false readings. So in this scenario, the sensors are giving false readings on the basis of false readings about the environment, the people, ourselves, history, the world, the universe, everything. False readings. We're making decisions and choices and hoping for some sort of grand outcome, right? A successful outcome. So what would be the proper calibration of the senses? Remember, in the 60s, there was a group called the Doors. Jim Morrison, the Doors. You might have heard of them or read about it on Wikipedia. So when at the time, when that name came, we all thought, that's kind of a weird name, the Doors. Just the Doors? You know, like, because everyone else had some other kind of name, like the Doors. And so, but then they said, well, what does that name mean? They said, well, because they were into psychedelics, and there was a person named Aldous Huxley who was very fond of psychedelics, and he wrote a book called The Doors of Perception. Right? And he was a ontological disciple, in a sense, of the British mystic poet William Blake. And William Blake is where the original statement about the doors of perception came from. And what he meant were the senses, which is interesting, because in Veda you have the dwaram and the gate with nine gates. And so he said, when the doors of perception are cleansed, they will see everything as it is, infinite. That was his saying. So when you've cleansed all your sense perception, you'll see everything as it is. And what is that? Infinite. But he didn't get very specific after that. That's what he said. So Huxley liked that, so he took doors of perception. Jim Morrison and his bandmates were under the influence of Huxley, and they thought, you know, Doors of Perception would be a long name for a band. So we're the Doors. But the important point to understand, the doors of perception are the senses. And he says, Blake, when they're cleansed, you'll see everything as it is, infinite. So I like to develop that idea. So then if we looked at it more carefully, then you would say, then there would be an infinite kind of seeing, an infinite kind of hearing. Or to reverse that, I mean, you would see, there's an infinite that can be seen. There would be an infinity that could be heard and tasted, touched, a touchable infinite, right? A seeable infinite, a hearable infinite. It might be an infinite you could have a dialogue with, who could be seen, heard, touched, tasted, smelt, felt, all of those things. That Govinda, that's Krishna by any other name. I like to quote the Queen Rukmini when she says, Shrutva gunan bhuvana sundara srinvatam te nirvishakarna vivare haratonga tapam rupam drisham drishimatam akilarta labam twaya chuta vishati chitram apatra pamme. And her reverse inverted kidnap letter to Krishna, because normally someone is kidnapped and then you get a ransom note. This is the inverse. She's sending the note and inviting Krishna to kidnap her. So that's different. So, and she's saying, why am I asking you to do this? Because Shrutva Gunan Bhuvana Sundar. You are Bhuvana Sundar. You're the most, hearing about you, I came to understand, you're the most beautiful thing in the world and beyond. Nothing and no one compares to you. That's Bhuvana Sundar. And Srinvatamte, this is the Dwarka queen. Remember, the Mihishi, Dwarka queens, the Lakshmis of Vaikuntha, even the Brajagopis, they're all expansions of Srimati Radharani. She is the ultimate woman. So Rukmini, she's saying, And because like nama, rupa, guna, lila, from sound, form comes out. So he's saying, I heard about you, your qualities, like I heard the gunas and the descriptions of Krishna, and then the form of Krishna appeared to me. And I say, nothing compares to your beauty, right? Achintya guna swarupam, yang shama sundaram achintya guna swarupam. But then she says something that's very, even more interesting. Srinvatamte, she said, then I understood why there's an auditory sense. This is a very telling and like emphatic remark. She's saying, this is why we have an auditory sense. Not that hearing about Krishna is one of the options of what you can do. Not for her, not for Radharani, not for Sukadeva Goswami, not for... like, even in the secular world, there are people who they have a higher appreciation for the arts. And, you know, they'll say, whether they're referring to some artist, some musical work or whatever, you know, say, or it could even be culinary experience, or tasting, you know, unless you've had this, they'll say, if you haven't had this, you haven't lived. Right? And they mean it when they say that. They're saying, it's that good. It's that beautiful. It tastes that good. You know, if you haven't tried, you know, your life has been wasted. Or you haven't lived. You're a dead man walking. Right? It betrays a certain type of intensity. This is the type of intensity devotees say when they say, like, if you haven't seen the form of Christ, like, what do you have eyes for? What are you doing with your eyes? They're so deep into the beauty of Krishna that it's unfathomable to them that you would have them for any other purpose. And it's real. Right? It's a unique position. And it's not like, oh, a bunch of fanatics or no, it's passion, passionate intensity. They're overwhelmed by what they're experiencing. So she's saying, hearing about you, I understood why there's such a thing as hearing. Seeing your divine form, I understood what eyes are for. This is what it's for. And what are we doing in the world while we're, you know, as John Lennon once said, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. So what are we doing in the, when we're, our default position is to look at beautiful things, to hear beautiful sounds, to taste beautiful, wonderful things, to have the full sensual experience. That's basically what's driving everyone. Right. Freud called it the pleasure principle, saying pleasure principle to him is to minimize suffering and maximize happy feelings. But when asked, what was the purpose of psychotherapy? Someone said, so is it to someone who's suffering neuroses, to they undergo psychotherapy and then they become happy? He said, no, that's not the purpose. And they said, well, what is the purpose? He said, the purpose of psychotherapy is someone is has neuroses, neurotic suffering, to convert that into ordinary suffering. That's its purpose. But that being said, our default position is the search for the beautiful, like reality the beautiful, the search for Sri Krishna, reality the beautiful. This is what the senses want. So if Blake says, when the doors of perception are cleansed, they'll see everything as it is, infinite, well, let's explore that infinite. Then that should... These are five different sensual possibilities. So there must be an infinite reciprocal for each one of them. So I mean, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, feeling. I don't know how far Blake went with it, as far as that is concerned. But when I like to compare this to aesthetic beauty, and as we, just to confirm with Nityananda Das, the Russian word, the Greek word is aesthetikos, and the Russian word is?
Aesthetica.
Huh?
Aesthetica, originated
okay.
from Greek.
Say it loud. Same thing.
Yes.
Now, and if you look at it etymologically, it's very interesting. What do you think? Oh, aesthetic culture, that's people, they like the fine things in life, or, you know, it's writers, critics of art, literature, etc. That's what it's become. But at the root of the word, and that's in the last 100, 200 years. Before that, what it means literally is what is perceivable by the senses. That's what it meant, aesthetikos. What the senses can perceive. But I find it interesting. In time, it became synonymous with refined sense experience. Seeing the most beautiful things, hearing the most beautiful sounds, tasting the most beautiful flavors. That, the personification of that, if you take that to the infinite degree, infinite magnitude, in its fullest expression, is personified as Krishna. That's who Krishna is. Someone says, Anadiradir Govinda, we're being told the original is Govinda, someone who is sensual and sensuous and is capable of sensuous reciprocation. Just like Rishikesh. In Sanskrit, Rishika Isha. So generally we'll say something like the Lord of the senses. But what does that mean? Just the Lord of the senses, what would that mean? Unless we think what it really means, you know, Hrishikesha, Hrishikena, Hrishikesha, Sevanam, Bhakti Ruchite. Hrishika Isha means, another way of putting it is, he's the ultimate expression or possibility, the infinite possibility of what could be seen, heard, tasted, touched, etc. And here in the sloka it says, Hrishikesha, Hrishikena, Hrishikena, Hrishikesha, Sevanam, Bhakti Ruchite. Sarvapadiyavinirmuktam, Vinirmuktam, Tatparatvena Nirmalam, Hrishikena, Hrishikesha, Sevanam, Bhakti Ruchite. Yeah. So if that's how he is and who he is, then that means that you can serve him with your senses. It's a very important thing to understand. Right? If he represents the ultimate expression of seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, feeling, etc., then that means you can use your ears, your eyes, all of your senses in the service of Krishna. Right? So, and if we want to circle back to the original question, then that's the, the escape method. Is to, by, as classically said, engaging your senses in the service of the master of the senses, then you're free from the sting. Sting. And no longer bound. Vidyate hridaya granti chidyante sarva sanshaya shiyante chasya karmani Drishta Akhilatmani, Mayi Drishta Akhilatmani. And just a final note. He said everyone, the Braja Gopis, the Mahishis, the Queens of Dwarka, the Lakshmis of Vaikuntha, etc., expansions of Radharani, their shadow representations are goddesses of this world. So when it says Chayeva Yasya Bhuvanani Vibhorti Durga, saying Durga Devi is a shadow representation of her spiritual counterpart. So in one of his lectures, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, was that a bat? It is a bat. Okay. Hare Krishna. Welcome to the bat community. Fortunately, we don't have the hot lights. So he said that Durga Devi's representation in the spiritual world is as a Braja Gopi. Right? But here, she's the superintendent of the jailhouse of the material world. It's one of the reasons why Bengalis worship Durga Devi. Their idea behind this is that by worshiping, like if you have a good relationship with the superintendent of the jail, then, you know, nice cell, privileges, maybe cable, Wi-Fi, you know. That's their idea. And Prabhupada used to always remind us, like, and what do they say? If you, and Gopal knows, and any Bengali knows, because they can hear on the loudspeakers, but I can hear it too, because I heard Prabhupada. And the one of the famous lines when they're offering the prayers is they go, Rupam Dehi. Remember, Rupam in Bengali means silver or money. It basically, Rupam Dehi means like, give me money, give me money, give me money, give me money, give me money. But someone from the Western world, they're going like, they think it's really cool. Someone going, Rupam Dehi, Rupam Dehi. They go, wow, that's really cool. I'm into that. What are they saying? Give me money, give me money, give me money, give me money. Maybe I'll have that tattooed on my arm, you know, Rupam Dehi. In Sanskrit or Bengali, it'd be really cool. Give me money. So that's the basis of all this goddess worship. What you can get for their, so they think, well, if they're in charge of the material world, and we don't really want to go to the spiritual world, we just want to have a nice, happy life here, then we should be worshiping them. But that said, we should end with a sweet. In the Brihad Bhagavatamritam, when Narada is visiting Shiva and offers him so much praise there, and Parvati is overhearing all, you know, she feels the ladies section is being underrepresented. And it's pointed out by Sanatana Goswami Prabhu in that section that sometimes there are just very sincere souls and they're worshiping Durga Devi or Mahakali. This is very rare, but very. And they're coming with another thing in mind and they may bless them with devotion. It's possible. A very rare occurrence. I don't know of any recorded instances, but it's mentioned. Hare Krishna. Anything else?
There is a question. If mercy does not care for any qualification, why we still perform our practice to acquire some qualification?
Why do we do what?
Render our service and just perform our practice, regular practice, to acquire some qualification.
Well, actual devotees do not. So that betrays our neophyte position, that we're doing something to get something. But the idea is, the more one comes in connection with Krishna consciousness substantially, that sort of motivation fades away. Right? The other companion sloka of Sarvapadi Vinirmuktam Tat is Anya Bilashita Shunyam Jnana Karmadyanavritam Anukuryena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhaktir Uttama. Uttama Bhakti is not tinged with ulterior motive, like karma or gyan. So, you know, to ulterior motive for some other purpose. So, in time, that should fall away. And a devotee is serving because Krishna conception is so compelling, they want to offer themselves in service, not with the expectation of any sort of remuneration. So we find in the Antya Lila of Charitamritam the statement, Das kori beton mori deho premadan. Beton means salary, and the proper prayer being expressed there is, let me serve you and let prem be my salary, not something else. And then Guru Maharaj annotates this by saying, and what do we find qualifies as prem proper? He introduced the concept of compound interest. So if we take it in this example, your capital investment, that's your seva. You're investing your serving capital. Serving Guru, Gauranga, you know, Guru and Vaishnav. Guru, Gauranga, Radha Govinda and their entourage. So that's your capital, that's your serving capital. You invest that. Then the interest comes from that investment in the form of prem. And Guru Maharaj said, then what does a genuine devotee do? They employ the principle of compound interest. They take the prem and increase the serving capital. So they're forever expanding their serving capital and they're happy with that. Then Guru Maharaj takes it to its next logical stage. Saying, well then, you're telling us that pure devotees do not allow a pinprick through which any remuneration can pass to them. Right? Not even a pinprick, right? Means the tiniest hole through which some remuneration, that's the nature of unalloyed pure devotion. Then Guru Maharaj said, then Krishna's perplexed. What to do? He would like to serve them, they won't allow it. As we hear in the story of Sanatan Goswami, Rupa Goswami, on Sanatan's appearance day, Rupa saying, my guru day, I want to make something very nice. And some girls from Yavat, the local village, cowherd girls, give him some extraordinary milk. He makes like some kheer. We're told, what? They're living under trees, like, Tyaktva Turnamashesha Mandalipati Shrinam Sada Tuchabhat Bhutva Dina Ganeshako Karunaya Kopina Kantasrito Gopi Bhava Vrsamritab Dilahari Kalola Magna Muhur Bande Rupa Sanatano Raguyago Shijivako Palago. And Sanatan's tasting this. He's also a rustic Vaishnava substantially. Except no substitute. And he can taste the substance, and it's extraordinary. And he's also thinking, Rup lives under a tree like I do. Where did he get this? And there's something, the taste of this substance is super extraordinary. So he says to Rupa Goswami, where did you get this? And he said, oh, one of the gopi girls from Yadvat, the nearby village, gave it to me. And Sanatan Goswami says, find her and bring her. I went to meet. And Rupa Goswami goes to the village. describes a girl. No one knows who that is. There's no girl who meets that description. So he returns empty-handed, and then Sanatana Goswami is like, "Oh, what have you done? What have we done?" And he's saying, "What?" He said, "Whom, like Ashavare Amrita Sindhu Mayukatanjit, whom our whole life is an aspiration to serve her holy lotus feet. We have accepted service from her." It was Radharani or her delegation. So he's saying, "This is the most horrible thing." We would be going, "Oh," we would, you know, go on Facebook and tell everybody about it. Right? Sanatana Goswami is saying, like, "The most horrible thing has happened. What's that? We receive service from Srimati Radharani. We are aspiring for Radha Dasyam, and now Radharani served us. What could, oh," and he runs away, he becomes feverish. We're told at the end that he's lying down on the ground and a, like, what's the state where, like, when you have the fever?
Delirium.
Delirious, like a fevered delirium. And someone lying nearby told, the heat that was being generated from Sanatana Goswami created blisters on their body. That's how upset he was at receiving service. So Guru Maharaj said, then Krishna's perplexed. I want to serve them. They won't receive any service from me. They won't allow it. Then what? Then Guru Maharaj said, then our opportunity comes. They may accept some service from us. Then if we serve them, he's saying, then you're doing the desired seva that Krishna wants to do. So how pleased he will be with you. That means an extreme amount, quality and quantity of Krishna's mercy. But that might be the aspiration of the lower section. But that means there's hope for us. Hare Krishna.